Thank you very much, Fern, and greetings to everyone. I hope your Passover season has been a very good one, a spiritually uplifting one, and an exciting one. I'm a little bit saddened that you can't see the floral arrangements. It just looks beautiful down here, and we'd like to lift it up so you could see it. Maybe this afternoon we'll be able to do something about that, but it's, in the meantime, very difficult to show it to you. But thank you very much for the work that was done in making this all possible, arranging it. And also for our group of individuals sort of behind the scenes. We have ourselves going on internet again today and cybercasting. So Martin is taking care of that and Leonard with the filming. So we do appreciate all of those things, and certainly the appreciation and thanks coming from God will be a lot better down the line. But all of us do need to sometimes just appreciate what we do for each other as we work together to serve God. We should ask ourselves on a day like this, and I'm sure many of our young people ask themselves, why is it that the rest of this world seems to be quite content in celebrating the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ with Easter eggs, with rabbits that they have fun with, and looking for little baskets that people hide, with eating Easter hams, hot cross buns, meeting together on a sunrise service the moment the sun comes up, and celebrating Good Friday? It doesn't take a lot of knowledge to understand that every one of these services or every one of these events tamper with scriptures. They're totally against the Bible, against what Jesus was. And for us all, the foundation of our beliefs rest in God and Jesus Christ. His example and his words reflected truth to all of us. And secondly, then his word, which is the Bible, also then reinforces that and reflects truth. So our foundation for belief is based in Jesus Christ and his actions and on the word of God as well. In 31 AD, that was the Passover season in which Jesus Christ was crucified, his disciples on the first holy day, I would think, spent the worst holy day they could possibly remember. The absolute worst. Their night to be remembered, which was really a night to be forgotten. That's a night they wanted to forget. It was a horrible time for them. Jesus Christ, their friend and their confidant, their leader, had been murdered, buried now, and they were traumatized by his death. And for many of them, they just wanted to quit. They just wanted to give up and quit and go fishing or do something, but they thought it was all done. There is a saying which almost everybody understands: if you cut off the head, the body can't function. Or if you destroy the shepherd, the sheep will scatter. And so that is even being tried, or was tried, certainly in Iraq. They removed the head, and the nation then was not functioning as a nation. And these individuals now, the disciples of Jesus Christ, were afraid for their own lives. Judas had already hung himself, and the others knew that they were amongst the leadership. Peter was accused of being a friend and a follower of Christ, remember? And he denied it and denied it and denied it, and then, of course, realized he shouldn't have denied it any longer. In the middle of all of this turmoil in their lives, a very unexpected thing happened. Totally unexpected to the disciples. Unexpected to the rest of society and the world. Now, there was a little bit of a maybe thought in the minds of some of the Pharisees and leaders, because Jesus had said very plainly that he'll be back. And so they thought, well, in case they come to steal him, no one thought he's going to wake up and come back to life and be resurrected. That wasn't the thought. Someone thought, well, maybe they'll steal a body, and then all these things might happen, and we can't find him and prove that he was actually dead. And so they put a guard on the tomb. 3 days had passed since that fearful event, and a quiet Sabbath evening was now approaching. Or for quiet Sabbath evening had just come to them, just like the week before in some ways. And nobody went to the tomb to see if that rock that was rolled in front of it was still there. Why should they go to the tomb? Nobody remembered Lazarus, it seemed, who had been resurrected, and the rock rolled away by men, of course. Lazarus was resurrected. No one remembered that or even thought remotely, possibly this was a forerunner of what could happen. No one even dared to dream that the unthinkable and the unexpected had happened, or even could happen. So the Sabbath day was over now. Everyone was still traumatized and exhausted by the events. And several of the women had realized at the burial of Jesus Christ, because they were there, that he was very quickly anointed and salve and ointment was put on him and very quickly buried. And so they wanted to do a better job. They wanted to do a little bit of a better job. And remember, these same women, when Lazarus was in the grave for 4 days, they said, when Jesus came to the graveside of Lazarus, they said, well, he stinks already. He's been dead 4 days. He stinks already. And they thought Jesus was dead already for 3 days and 14 hours, almost 4 days. They thought he was already dead for 3 days and 14 hours. Actually, Jesus Christ had been dead for 72 hours, 3 days and three nights. Let's have a look in the book of Luke and see what the Bible tells us, because that is the most important thing to comprehend and understand, no matter what people think. You know, human beings in this world are making a horrible mess out of life, a horrible mess out of their futures. The drug scene, the loss of direction and sense of belonging and what we are as human beings has just ripped our societies apart. And our youth are heading for a disastrous future. In Luke chapter 23, you know, all of the world is, I shouldn't say just our youth, when I say ours, I don't mean ours personally, but the whole world is. The children in the church of God have a desire and a hope and a direction and a goal. They know there's something happening and something bigger will happen. But Luke chapter 23, bringing back to our unexpected theme, we're going to start in verse 53. This is where Joseph of Arimathea, who was a wealthy and influential man amongst the Jews, went to Pontius Pilate in verse 52 and asked for the body of Jesus. That took some time. We estimate Jesus died right around 3 o'clock, 3 or 4 o'clock. And from about a mile away, they had to walk in to see Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate sent a guard out to make sure he had died. And he came back again. So there's about a 4-mile walk in there for somebody, or even going a little bit faster would have taken probably a good hour or more. And then in verse 53, he received permission, so he took the body down. And that took some time as well. He wrapped it in linen and laid it in a tomb that was hewn out of rock where no one had ever laid before. Now, when you put the four gospel messages together, it does say that they put ointments on that body of Jesus Christ. And then they laid it in this tomb where nobody had ever laid before. And the day was the preparation. The Sabbath drew near. Now, any day before a Sabbath day is a preparation day. Just as if you're going to have an exam, you prepare for that exam ahead of time. You study ahead of time. Or we keep the weekly Sabbath. Friday is a day where you should be concentrating on making sure you don't have extra things or unnecessary things to do on the Sabbath. So it was in preparation, and the Sabbath drew near. And the women who had come with him from Galilee followed after. So they were carrying this body. The women followed. They observed the tomb and how his body was laid. And it was laid in there just at the setting of the sun, just as the sun went down. And then they returned. And, of course, the Sabbath had begun, so they prepared spices, and they did not do that on the Sabbath. What happened was they kept the Sabbath. They rested. In other scriptures, it does say Sabbaths, plural. And they rested on the Sabbath according to the commandment. So they kept the first high Sabbath. Friday came along, which we will see, and lived through this week in a sense. And they rested. They worked on Friday to prepare the ointments, to buy them, prepare them. And then they rested on the weekly Sabbath. And then they went down early in the morning. That was the sequence of events. And we can understand that this was happening. Now, while we're in this thought pattern, we're understanding that the first holy day, as it was for us this week, the first holy day was Thursday. And the preparation day would have been then on Wednesday. And Wednesday was also Nisan the 14th, when Jesus would have been crucified and did die. Burial occurred, and the Thursday was the day where they went and buried him just at the setting of the sun, Wednesday evening. Thursday, Nisan the 15th, was starting, the first holy day. And then Friday was, just as this week, not a holy day, but a work day or a preparation day for the Sabbath itself. Now, in Matthew 27... In Matthew 27, we can pick up a little more of the story, and I won't be going into all of the details, because that's not the focus of the sermon today. But in Matthew 27, we can begin reading in verse 50, an event had occurred. See, this wasn't just something small that was occurring. These were big things that were occurring sort of simultaneously. The darkness that came, the storm that came, the earthquake that occurred, and all this was simultaneously occurring with the death of Jesus Christ. In verse 50, Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. So very likely that was a moment where he was stabbed with this huge spear from the Roman, and they had big spears. He was stabbed, and as a spear was pulled out, there are things which probably tore his body open, and he died at that moment. And that moment then, in verse 51, then behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. This wasn't a little sort of a veil that was 6 feet high. This was a huge canopy, a veil that closed off this part of the temple. And to have that ripped from top to bottom had never happened before. This was a miracle and a wonder that occurred, a frightening event. Certainly for the Pharisees and scribes. But it was ripped in two from the top to the bottom, not just a little tear, but the whole thing was ripped right in half. And you know, you can just think of this. If you try to take a curtain and tear it, now how do you tear it from the top right to the bottom, completely in asunder it? It's difficult to do. You sort of got to keep tearing to the last little bit. But this was just ripped right in apart. And then a marvelous thing happened in verse 52 as well. Through the earthquakes, graves were opened. Now what happened was many of the graves there are not like our graves, 6 foot under the ground and covered over. Those graves were above ground. They're like little mausoleums and catacombs, or Jesus buried in a sort of a cave of a rock like that. And during this earthquake, they simply cracked. They cracked open. Now, it was a holy day coming up as well, so no one could do anything about it. No one did anything about it. Those graves stayed open. Maybe you could look inside and see the corpse, a hand hanging out or something like that. But the graves were open, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised and coming out of the graves. Then the word 53 in verse 53 is after his resurrection. So for 3 days and three nights, those graves laid open, split somehow or other to allow those bodies to come out when God decided to resurrect them. There was a great lesson in this. The lesson of the resurrection of the dead is involved here. And what Jesus was about to show, what God was about to show, is the concept of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, which nobody was expecting. Nobody was even wildly dreaming of this happening. So after his resurrection then, those graves which had split open at the moment of his death, after his resurrection, 3 days and three nights later, people began coming out of there. They went into the holy city and appeared to many. Now, when you think about that just a little bit, you know, your great uncle or grandfather, whoever it was, comes up all of a sudden and says, "Hello, I'm back again." You can imagine the scene in the city of Jerusalem. I don't know who was resurrected, but I would think that God resurrected those who he loved, who he cared about. People like Lazarus had been resurrected. But God didn't just resurrect anybody. He resurrected some very specially selected, unique people. And when they appeared in Jerusalem, these people appeared, it must have been shocking to everybody, amazing to everybody. People must have been going around and wondered what had happened, what is happening, what's going on. In the midst of all of this, there's another great event happening. And you know, we tend to want to deny some things around us. We want to deny that things are happening. I'm sure the people of Iraq wanted to not believe that there was a big army coming, that the Americans would arrive in Baghdad. If you heard their communications experts, you know, Americans were in the middle of Baghdad, and he was saying, "They're not here yet. They aren't going to be here. They've been annihilated," and all the things he was saying. People want to bury their heads in the sand and not face the truth of life. The truth of the decisions that we make and the price that we have to pay for our bad decisions. But in the book of Revelation, let's go there for a moment, because another thing was happening, which was also unseen to them, to human beings, and we might say unexpected, but something else was happening. And again, it's just a little mention of it. The clarity of this point isn't perhaps something which we can discuss. But in Revelation chapter 12, we see the brief story of Satan here and an involvement with the church. So in verse 1 it says, a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet and on her head, a garland of 12 stars, and then being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 diadems on his head. His tail drew 1/3 of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth, and the dragon stood before the woman. So this is an event where the woman is about to bring forth, give birth to Jesus Christ. Now, whether this is talking about Mary, it certainly would not be, I would think, talking about Mary giving birth to the baby, although that was part of it, but also the very moment of the death of Christ, that was the turning point of history. Now, it all began, of course, with his birth, but his death and his resurrection were enormous events that had to do with everything to do with the hope and desire of people that were to come. So the dragon, Satan, stood before the woman, the church, we can say, who was ready to give birth, to devour her child as soon as it was born. So while Christ was dying, all the demons were there and Satan was there mocking him and laughing at him and inspiring people to say, come on, get off of that cross if you are the Savior, and all these various things were happening and going on. But it says in verse 5, she bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up to God and to his throne. That occurred at the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ 40 days later. And the woman then fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God that they should feed her there for 1,260 days. So the woman was taken, the church was taken into a wilderness or a place where she was hidden. And of course, from that time on, from the very death of Christ, she had to be hidden because Satan was after the woman. Satan has been trying to persecute this woman ever since. The battle has gone on. So there are spiritual things happening that we aren't always aware of. And with the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, there are 30 prophecies, specific prophecies, that you can detail and outline, given hundreds of years before, that all came to pass within 24-hour span of time. Incredible. It's never happened before. 30 detailed prophecies all came to pass within a 24-hour span of time. One of the points in which the scriptures in the Old Testament certainly is silent, and perhaps a reason why the disciples didn't have any reason to expect anything to happen. You know, they had seen a lot of dead people. In those days, when someone in your family died, you would take the body to your home and you'd wash the body up and you'd put ointment on it and wrap linen in it and find a place to bury it. You would do it all. Now, the only thing you had was professional mourners for some, and maybe there were some who'd come along and help you embalm or entomb or bury the body. But most families took care of their own dead people. And when that happens, you know, you're close to that person. You know that person has died. When in our town where I grew up, in the coal mines, we had one doctor in town. When a man died or was killed by accident, he wasn't immediately just taken anywhere. He was put in a little room in the wash house where the boys could go and have a shower. But there was a special little room there for a person who was killed in an accident. The doctor would proclaim him dead. His friends, the men he worked with, his co-workers, would come and take him, and they'd wash him and scrub him in the showers there and lay him out in this box and get him ready to be put on the next train out to Edson. So everybody sort of knew what was happening, and you knew this person was dead. And so it was with the disciples. They knew that Jesus was dead. They had no thought that anything was going to happen in his life. In the Old Testament, it doesn't say that there would be a resurrection. It doesn't say 3 days and three nights he'll be in the grave. Oh, there's some little inklings if you knew where to look, but it really doesn't give you the indication at all. It isn't until Jesus Christ told them what was going to happen. And he did tell them again and again and again and again. But, like so many other human beings in this earth, like us all, I guess, we are slow to listen, aren't we? We're slow to learn and slow to listen. In Matthew chapter 12, let's go back there a little ways. Now we know that the night to be forgotten for the disciples in the end turned out to be a very happy and joyful time. When they comprehended and understood the enormity of what had happened, and not only what happened to Jesus Christ, but what it meant for the rest of the world, what it meant for human beings ultimately. Then they were excited and delighted. In Matthew chapter 12 and verse 38, some of the scribes and Pharisees asked Jesus questions here and answered, saying, "Teacher, we want to see a sign from you." And Jesus answered them, scribes and Pharisees who were listening, and he said, an evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign. So he was right away telling them what they were. They were sinners. They were breaking the laws of God. They were thumbing their noses at God. And it's funny how a person can thumb his nose at God, and because he doesn't get slapped on the side of the head right away, he sort of thinks God isn't there, or doesn't care, or doesn't matter. No, if in the kingdom of God, it'll be different. If someone's going to do something or want to do something bad, and boy, there's going to be a voice in his ear. Then there'll be a little fist in his ear, I think, to stop and prevent that from happening. But in our world, you know, we haven't gotten there yet. We have lots yet to learn. So he said, an evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and no sign will be given to it except there is a sign. The one sign, and it's not from Friday night until Sunday morning. The one sign, he says, is going to be given, except the sign of the prophet Jonah. But no one ever thought of Jonah being a sign for the future. So this was totally unexpected. He says, as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. Now, these are the words directly from Jesus Christ, directly from God, written in the scriptures, not to be tampered with, not to be fiddled with, not to be changed, just to be believed. And if a person believes these words, we would all be keeping the holy days of God. Because it's precisely because of the respect that God had for his Sabbath days that all of this occurred precisely as it did. And that's also why the Passover was instituted in Nisan the 14th, way back there at the time of Israel. And even further back at the time of Abraham and Isaac, if we care to look into these things. So he says the men of Nineveh are going to rise up in judgment with this generation and condemn it because they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and indeed a greater than Jonah is here. And others, sometimes looking from the outside in, would say that. So 3 days and three nights is what Jesus said here. In the book of Mark, Mark also recorded some of the words of Jesus Christ. In the book of Mark, chapter 8, and in verse 31, Mark chapter 8 and verse 31, Jesus began to teach them. He was teaching them, his own people here. And he said, the Son of Man, in verse 31 of Mark 8, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke this word openly, and then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Peter just wouldn't accept it, couldn't accept it. It was not in Peter's plan. It was not in Peter's concepts. And so we are like that as people, aren't we? We have our own ideas. We have our own concepts of what is right and wrong, and no one's going to tell us what's right or wrong. So he spoke the word openly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But Jesus said, after, and the word after is important, 3 days, he will rise again. Not during, and not at the beginning of. And it sort of tells you then it's at the end of it, after 3 days, he will rise again. If we go to Luke chapter 13, you know, there's a lot of arguments in the theological centers and circles, and of course, almost every church accepts the Good Friday concept. That is the death of Jesus Christ Friday afternoon, and the burial, and the resurrection early Sunday morning. That's what they accept. And try as you might, no matter what mathematics you use, you can never find 3 nights and 3 days, or 3 days and three nights in that scenario. But people do try. And even if they can't find it, they say, oh well. We'll believe it anyway. We'll accept it anyway. So in the book of Luke, chapter 13, and verse 31, on that very day, verse 31, some Pharisees came to Jesus, to him, saying, get out and depart from here, for Herod wants to kill you. So there were some who respected him and said, you are a teacher sent from God, and they were kind of warning him here, and he said, go and tell that fox, that King Herod, behold, I cast out demons and perform cures or healings today and tomorrow, and the third day I shall be perfected. The third day. And so here again, he was explaining to them what was going to happen. And then in Luke 18, he goes on even further with his explanation. Luke 18 and verse 31. Here he took his 12 disciples, including Judas, aside and said, "Behold, we're going up to Jerusalem, and all things that are written by the prophets concerning the Son of Man will be accomplished." How many things? Well, at least 30 direct prophecies on that very same day. 30. The nails in his hand, the holes in his hands and feet being among them. The scourging that he was going to endure. And just all these points. 30 individual detailed prophecies. Even things he couldn't control, like being buried in a new grave amongst the rich. In that kind of a grave. Not being thrown over the hill in the valley of Hinnom where the other two thieves were thrown. Because they weren't buried, they were thrown in the garbage pile. For the crows to eat and the buzzards to come and feed on. In verse 32, he said, "For he will be delivered to the Gentiles and will be mocked and insulted and spit upon." To the Gentiles. He even stated who was going to kill him. It was the Romans, not the Jews. I mean, the Jews made sure it happened, but it was the Romans that actually killed him. It's another prophecy, you might say. "And spit on, they will scourge him and kill him, and the third day he will rise again." But, verse 34, "they understood none of these things. The saying was hidden from them, and they did not know the things which were spoken." It's an amazing thing when Jesus speaks so plainly, and his disciples are listening to him and don't get it. Just go right over their heads. And what we should see here is there's times where God doesn't want us to understand something. He just doesn't want us to, for that moment. He says, later on you'll understand it. And lots of times in prophecy, you know, people stumble all over the place trying to verify prophetic statements and prophetic things. But here he said plainly to them what was going to happen, and God purposely hid, even from the disciples, that understanding. And sometimes later on you'd ask from the disciples, "Did I have to agonize that much?" Peter crying over what he said and cursing Christ and the other disciples, you know, just agonizing over this crucifixion of their leader. They had to go through that, and believing he was dead for 3 days and three nights, they never dreamt he would live. It's just like Jacob. You know, for years, decades, God let him believe that his son Joseph was dead. And didn't tell Joseph, didn't even whisper in his ear to Jacob, "It's okay, you'll see him again." No, he did give Joseph the dreams to tell his father, but Jacob just wouldn't get it. And God didn't let him understand it. And so his disciples didn't, and we shouldn't feel bad if there's things we don't perfectly understand. In the book of John, chapter 2, and there are a few other scriptures, I won't turn to every single one of them, but we know that you can find these within the Bible. John chapter 2 and verse 19, Jesus answered and said to them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." So again, he points out that it will be 3 days. And the Jews said, "It's taken 46 years to build this temple, and you say you'll raise it up in 3 days." But in verse 21, he was speaking of the temple of his body. Now, John understood that later on. He was probably there when Jesus said those words and couldn't quite comprehend it. And so when we think of putting the scriptures together that we've just read to you, then we have to come up with the concept that it was not a death of Jesus Christ and a crucifixion of Friday morning, dying Friday afternoon, being put in the tomb late Friday afternoon or evening, early in the evening at sunset, and then rising early Sunday morning. That wasn't the way it happened. Let's go to Mark 15. It's good for us during this time of the year to rehearse and reiterate some of these points, because they were great, great wonders, and they changed the world. These things which occurred and happened changed the whole world. Mark 15, beginning in verse 42. It says, "When evening had come, because it was the preparation day, and that is the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea, a prominent council member who was himself waiting for the kingdom of God, coming and taking courage, went to Pilate to ask for the body of Jesus." So here we see that there were prominent people, wealthy people, religious people, who did have an understanding and a comprehension. Dr. Bakayoki said, for example, that even in Andrews University of the Seventh-day Adventist Church in Andrews, not called Andrews University, but the Seventh-day Adventist anniversary, there are professors there who keep the holy days. even though they said the Adventist Church does not observe it. Some individual professors actually keep these days. And so in Jerusalem, in the Sadducees, amongst the Pharisees, there were a few who were right on track. They were very, very sincere, and they knew that Jesus was a teacher sent from God. They did not rebuke him. They did not put him down. They were looking for this Messiah. So Pilate marveled that he was already dead and summoned the centurion and asked him if he had been dead for some time. So he had to go back and find out. When he found out that from the centurion, he granted the body to Joseph. So there were at least three or four trips back and forth from where Pontius Pilate was to where Christ had died. And then he brought fine linen, took him down, the body down, and wrapped him in the linen. Now, Joseph didn't do this by himself. There were a group of individuals there. The disciples were there. They saw this and were certainly helping him bring the body down. The women were there. He laid him in a tomb which had been hewn out of rock and rolled a stone against the door of the tomb. And Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, observed where he was laid. So these women who later would go back saw where he was laid. They saw the rock that was put there. And later on, the next day or the day after, the Pharisees had a special seal even put on the rock and set a guard there to make sure no one would steal the body. Now, when you put these scriptures together, if we focus in on the time, 3 days and three nights, and any one of our young people can do this, even children in grade one can calculate this, 3 days and three nights. A night can be 12 hours, and a day would be 12 hours. But if we, as we do celebrate and did celebrate the Passover service itself on Tuesday night, knowing that Wednesday was Nisan the 14th, and we stated and said and believed that he was crucified this week on Wednesday and died around 3 or 4 o'clock, was buried close to 5:30 or 6 o'clock. And that coincides with the same days lined up in 31 A.D., when Jesus then would have died on a Wednesday. And it's an interesting thing to note as well, that that the Friday date rolls around differently. I mean, for example, Passover date changes each year, simply because you're taking the 14th of Nisan. Good Friday, if it were a specific date, would have to change if they were going to follow the dates themselves. But they just select a Friday and that's it. And that's the way the celebrations of the Easter belief. So even that is in error, even from the Roman calendars. But it only makes sense then. If Jesus died on the Wednesday and was buried right at sundown, the end of Nisan the 14th, the beginning of the Holy Day, which is the 15th, then you have one night, which would have been for us Wednesday night, and one day, which is Thursday, right up until the end of that day. And then we have the next night, which would be Thursday night, and the day would be Friday. Then you have the next night, which is Friday night, in our terminology, which would be the third night. And you have the day, which is the Sabbath or Saturday, the third day. It is said he rose after the third day or on the third day. Many, many statements are made like that. And the understanding we have to have from that is he was resurrected then at the end of the Sabbath itself, towards the end of it. 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. I'm not sure God took the moment of his death to resurrect him or the moment of his burial to resurrect him. That's not as important as understanding it was at the end of the Sabbath day. So that on that Sabbath, that quiet Sabbath in which no one went to the tomb, no one went to check, no one went to see, that rock had been rolled away. The tomb was empty. The clothing with which Christ was wrapped were laying there. And the handkerchief or face piece they put over the face was neatly folded and put aside. And he was gone. So this happened then by Saturday night. It's very easy to calculate that. You can just put night, day, or go backwards if you want to. Try it from Sunday morning. How do you do it from Sunday morning? You know, night, day. Well, you have to have him dying early in the morning, you know, a previous Thursday. And it doesn't work at all. But knowing that he died late in the evening, then you know he was resurrected late in the evening as well. Let's go to Matthew chapter 28. And you know, it's a good thing for us from time to time to put this down in this way, especially this year. where we do know then that the dates and the days coincided with all of this, so that our night to be much remembered, which was Wednesday night, the beginning of Nisan the 17th, was a night where the disciples wanted to forget. It was a gloomy, terrible night as far as they were concerned. There was no happiness for them. For those 3 days and three nights, there was no happiness. No rejoicing on the holy day, no rejoicing on the Sabbath for them at all. Until they began to understand what had happened. In Matthew chapter 28, if we read beginning in verse 1, it says, "Now after the Sabbath, as the first day of the week began to dawn." Now this is an incorrect translation. When you have a Bible which is translated from one language to another, and it doesn't matter which language you use, you translate from English to German, guaranteed, you're not going to be able to have the meanings clearly stated. There will be errors, there will be mistakes. And there are minor ones, small ones, but they can make a huge difference. So instead of saying after the Sabbath, the correct Greek is after the Sabbaths, plural. There was more than one Sabbath. And there was. There was the first holy day of the year and the weekly Sabbath. So the correct Greek then says, after the Sabbath, as the first day of the week began to dawn. Now that was Sunday morning when it began to dawn. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to see the tomb. Now it was not quite light enough to see. It was dark. It was still dark out. And they came and they probably had a good mile or so to walk. So they probably started walking at 4 in the morning or 4:30 in the morning, which you would think would be a dangerous time for women to be walking on the streets. But in those days it wasn't so bad. "And behold, there was a great earthquake," and there had been a great earthquake, "for the angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat on it. His countenance was like lightning, and his clothing was as white as snow. And the guards shook for fear of him and became like dead men." That didn't happen as the women were approaching. That had happened. That had happened Saturday afternoon. The guards just fainted, passed out, and stayed that way. "They shook for fear of him and became like dead men. But the angel answered and said to the women, 'Do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified.'" This was already before sunrise. You know, you have a sunrise service because you think the sunrise service is in commemoration of the rising of the Son of God. But it really is a resurrection of an old sunrise service where you worship the sun as it rises. And it's amazing how, you know, humans just don't connect the two. You know, and I don't know what it is with in the human mind. It's sort of like, you know, denying yourself, thinking you can go gambling and blow all your money and then yet drive a Jaguar, you know, or own a nice home or go on vacations and so on. If you lead yourself into poverty, you stay in poverty. But the mind denies it. The mind of a gambler totally denies that. The mind of a drinker denies that he drinks. The mind of an abusive person denies that they are abusive. Everybody else is, not me. So here they came then to Jesus Christ and to where he was, and the angel said, "Do not be afraid. I know you seek Jesus who was crucified. He is not here. He is risen as he said. Come and see the place where the Lord lay. And go quickly and tell his disciples that he is risen from the dead." Now the ladies didn't come inside and have a look. They were too scared to do that. They were so nervous and so scared and so concerned and so traumatized by the events here. They maybe looked like that from a distance and turned and ran. And the angel went on to say, "Indeed, he is going before you into Galilee, and there you'll see him. Behold, I have told you." And so they went out quickly from the tomb with fear and great joy and ran to bring his disciples word. And as they went to tell his disciples, behold, Jesus met them, saying, "Rejoice." And so they came and held him by the feet and worshipped him. And Jesus said, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brethren and go to Galilee." Now there are other things that had happened in the meantime here, because Jesus Christ could not be touched until he had been resurrected. So this wasn't the very first moment that they had actually seen him. They came and they saw this. They ran back, and now they had come back again. We can see that in John chapter 20. You have to sort of take each of the stories and put them together, as the Bible says, written a little bit here and a little bit there, for the sequence of these incredible events. In John chapter 20, the story is paralleled. We can begin in verse 1. "On the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb early while it was still dark and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb." And that's what had happened then. The angels had done that, and the tomb was open. "And she turned around and ran," in verse 2, "and came to Simon Peter and the other disciples whom Jesus loved. And she said, they've taken away the Lord out of the tomb. We don't know where they laid him. And so Peter therefore went out and the other disciples and were going to the tomb, and they both ran together. Now they didn't run to see a resurrected Christ. They ran to find out if somebody had stolen his body. I mean, they loved that man. He was very special to them, and they had been through a lot of learning. Now, Peter had already denied him, and all these things were in his mind, and so they ran together, and Peter, being maybe a little bit older, a little bit heavier, didn't make it first. He came afterwards. He ran a bit slower. So in verse 4, they both ran together, and the other disciple outran Peter and came to the tomb first. That's interesting that he didn't go in. He just came there, and he stopped, or stooped down, and he looked in, he peeked in, he saw the linen clothes lying there, but he did not go in. And then Simon Peter came following him and went into the tomb, and he saw the linen clothes lying there. The handkerchief that had been around Jesus' head, not lying with the linen cloths, but folded together in a place by itself. And the other disciple who came to the tomb first went in also then, and he saw, and he believed. Now what did he believe? What did he believe? Well, verse 9, they did not know the scripture that he must rise again from the dead. So he didn't believe he rose from the dead, did he? He believed he was gone. The body was gone. The tomb was open. So the disciples went away again into their own homes, and they were puzzling and they were confused, not knowing what was going on and happening. And so then we read about Mary, as we had read previously. She stood outside by the tomb weeping, and as she wept, she stooped down and looked into the tomb. And she saw two angels in white, sitting one at the head and the other at the feet, where the body of Jesus had lain. Now she had seen Peter go in and the disciple go in and come out. They didn't say there was anybody else in there. So she looks inside. And this wasn't something which happened every day. Can you imagine the mindset of Mary here, or even of the disciples? This is something which had never happened in their lives, ever. Not anything even close to this. So what would you be thinking? And what would you say with this? Well, they started talking to her and said, "Woman, why are you weeping?" And she said, "Because they've taken away my Lord, and I don't know where they've laid him." And when she said this, she turned around and she saw Jesus standing there and didn't know that it was Jesus. Now, when your eyes are full of tears and you're not looking too closely and you're scared and all that's going on, perhaps you didn't recognize him. Perhaps he had a cloak over his face. You couldn't see exactly who it was. But Jesus said, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" And she, supposing him to be the gardener, said, "Sir, if you've carried him away, tell me where you've laid him, and I will take him away." And then Jesus said to her, "Mary." And she must have recognized his voice right at that moment. It just, ding, she recognized his voice, and she turned and said, "Rabboni," which is teacher. And then Jesus says, "Don't cling to me. Don't touch me." So this was the first time she saw him, not when she could touch him and hold his feet and worship him. "Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father, but go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father, to your Father, to my God, and to your God." An incredible, an enormous set of events that occurred and happened here. And Mary went and she told the disciples that she had seen the Lord. He spoke these things to her, and of course, they didn't believe her either. They weren't going to believe her. They had seen the tomb. The body was gone. They knew that. But to think that he was actually alive and speaking to her, that was incredible. That was unbelievable. But she did tell him what he had said to her. And from then on, you know, she was kind of a special person, Mary Magdalene. Apparently, she was the one that Jesus had cast seven demons out of her. You know, and she was a person maybe that said, well, she's sort of got funny thoughts anyway. I mean, she's had these demons and all these things. So maybe her reputation wasn't one of being the most pristine, outstanding person. I'm not sure. She was obviously somebody who Jesus cared about greatly and whom he gladly helped and served, and perhaps God gave her the special blessing and special gift because of her devotion as well. Let's go to the book of Luke now and pick the story up a bit further. Because things kept on happening on this day. The unexpected kept happening. It hadn't even reached the full zenith yet, but it kept on happening. So she had seen Jesus, and he said, "Don't touch me." No one yet besides that had seen him. In Luke 24, there was a story here of two of his disciples. This isn't necessarily of the 11, but two of his disciples were walking away. They were quitting, in a sense. They were on their way hiking to go back home. It's verse 13. "Behold, two of them were traveling the same day to a village called Emmaus, which was 7 miles from Jerusalem." So they were walking along the road, traveling out of Jerusalem at this on this particular day. Now maybe they weren't leaving for good. It still was the holy season, the Passover season, and there still was another holy day to come, which would have been like today. And this was on the Sunday, as it was in this week of ours. But that was a very eventful day, not the day Christ was resurrected, but it was the day after his resurrection, the first day of the week, in which he was teaching so many things. And they talked together of all these things which had happened. And so it was, while they talked, in verse 15, and reasoned, that Jesus himself drew near and went with them. And their eyes were restrained, so that they did not know him. And he said to them, "What kind of conversation is this that you have with one another as you walk and are sad?" And one said, his name was Cleophas, said to him, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem, and have you not known of these things which happened here in these days?" And he said to them, "What things?" And so they said to him the things concerning Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him to be condemned to death and crucified. But we're hoping that it was he who was going to redeem Israel. So they had a different concept, a different hope about Jesus Christ. And their hopes, their plans, their thoughts were pushed aside. Something unexpected happened to them. Besides all this, today is the third day since these things happened. And there's lots of argument and discussion about that. "Yes, a certain woman of our company who arrived at a tomb early astonished us. And when they could not find his body, they came saying that they had also seen a vision of the angels who had said he was alive. And certain of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the woman said, but he they did not see." So they still were not believing he was resurrected. If these two had believed that Christ was resurrected, they'd never be walking out of Jerusalem. They wouldn't have been walking out there. They'd be getting together with the other disciples and sitting there looking and waiting and wondering with Mary what's going to happen next. And then Jesus spoke to them. And again, they didn't recognize him at first. He said, "O foolish ones and slow of heart to believe in all that the prophets have spoken. Ought not the Christ to have suffered these things and to enter into his glory? And beginning with Moses and the prophets, he expounded to them all the scriptures, the things concerning him." All of the 30 prophecies that came to pass on that very day. And all the other prophecies before that, his birth in Bethlehem, and all these various things that were to happen. And they were listening and listening, but I would imagine, again, with the trauma, you know, you're down in the dumps, you're not feeling happy, you're listening, but you're not listening. You know what I mean? I would say that happened to these individuals. They were listening, but they weren't really listening. He was repeating these things to them. And verse 28, when they drew near the village where they were going, he indicated he would have gone further. And they constrained him, saying, "Stay with us, abide with us, for it's towards evening and the day is far spent." And so he did. He went in to stay with them. It was a very important point, lesson he was going to teach them here. It came to pass in verse 30, he sat down at the table with them, and he took bread, blessed it, and broke it, and gave it to them. This was the days of unleavened bread. He blessed and broke unleavened bread, gave it to them. He didn't say, "This is my body," but he had said that before. Then their eyes were opened and they knew him, and he vanished from their sight. Wow, you maybe want to reach out. Can you imagine what these two individuals thought? We had a dream, we saw a vision. What's happening here? The fear that would be there, the excitement, because Mary said she saw him too. The excitement maybe was beginning to build. So they said to one another, "Didn't our hearts burn within us while he talked with us on the road and while he opened the scriptures to us?" So they rose up that very hour and returned to Jerusalem and found the 11 and those who were with them gathered together. So there's something was happening. And these fellows must have been in pretty good shape. They just went 7 miles, turned around, came right back 7 miles. Went to Jerusalem and they said, "The Lord is risen indeed, and has appeared to Simon." And they told about the things that had happened on the road, how he was known to them in the breaking of the bread. And now, as they said these things, Jesus himself stood in the midst of them and said, "Peace to you." Wow. comes through the wall, stands in the middle of all of them. Now, these things were done for a very, very important reason. And that was the unbelievable thought that there indeed would be a resurrection that God offers to all of mankind. And so Jesus began then to give points of understanding and to teach them. In verse 36 to 48, he began to teach them some very wonderful things. They were terrified in verse 37. Terrified and frightened and thought they were looking at a ghost. Have you ever been terrified for a moment and frightened? You know, your brain stops. If you're terrified, you know, your mind is kicking into gear, fight or flight, usually flight, you know, run. But for a moment, you just get sort of stuck. You stop thinking. And you're either run or stay. You're not sure what to do. Well, these people were terrified. Wouldn't you be? You know, my father died in 1960. If he walked through this wall and sat, and you know, I'd stop talking very quickly. I'd be terrified. What am I seeing? Now, as long as he's not going to grab a hold of me, you know, maybe it wouldn't be so bad. But anyway, they were terrified. What did Jesus look like? What did they actually see here? Did they see the same body that they had buried with the holes in the side and the hands? You know, did they see the holes from the crown of thorns that was on his face? What did they see actually with Jesus Christ? Or was he beautiful, handsome, lovely? You know, obviously they saw the Christ that had died and was resurrected, because that was what was supposed to be reinforced. So they were terrified and frightened. They'd seen a spirit, and he said to them, "Why are you troubled? And why do doubts arise in your hearts?" Doubts because he had told them he's going to be back. They'd seen Lazarus resurrected. And there were others running around now in the city. Remember the tombs, the graves that cracked open? And others were running around who they all knew were dead for some time. "Behold my hands and my feet, that it is myself. Handle me and see, for a spirit does not have flesh and bones, as you see I have. Behold my hands and feet." So he had, obviously, holes in his feet. You know, they didn't put little wee tiny shingle nails in there. They put good-sized spikes, about the size of your thumb, through his feet and his hands. And they could see that. And when he said this, he showed them his hands and his feet. And while they still did not believe for joy, and they marveled, and he said, "Have you got something to eat?" I got an interesting question. "Have you got something to eat?" Wow. You know, of all the questions or the comments that would be made, I would have not expected that one. "Have you got some food?" Well, of course, he hadn't eaten for 3 days and three nights, and another day had passed. This was the fourth day he hadn't eaten, so maybe he was getting hungry. So they gave him a piece of broiled fish and some honeycomb, and he took it, and he ate it in their presence, and he said, "These are the words which I spoke to you while I was still with you. Don't you remember?" We just read them all in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. "That all things must be fulfilled which were written in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms concerning me." Psalm 22, marvelous psalm with detail after detail after detail of the death of Jesus Christ. Psalm 23 has also got points in there. So he opened their understanding that they might comprehend the scriptures. What a wonderful thing. Lessons for all of us are to be learned in here. And certainly we understand that God doesn't have to give us a total, a perfect understanding all of the time of everything. He doesn't make it clear right away. If he did, where would faith be required? Where would trust be required? You know, and faith and trust is what we require, we need to have at least, God requires of us, faith and trust in the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And for you and me, even more than for the disciples who lived at that time. Because they were able to see his body buried. They were able to see him resurrected, had seen Lazarus resurrected, and had maybe talked to some others who were resurrected at that time, and could put their hand in his side if they wanted to. I don't think you would want to. I think that, you know, it'd be enough to maybe touch him. But it's an amazing thought, what they saw, what they were supposed to be able to then believe. He opened their understanding, and he said in verse 46, "Thus it is written that it was necessary for the Christ to suffer and rise from the dead the third day." Now, it is an important point, brethren, that we understand and comprehend that Jesus' only sign was 3 days and three nights in the grave. And you can't get that by the way this world worships God and strives to understand the resurrection of Jesus Christ. He was not resurrected Sunday morning. He was resurrected Sabbath afternoon. That underscores and underlines the whole meaning and concept of the Sabbaths and the holy days of God. So he says in verse 47 also, and that repentance and remission of sins should be preached in his name to all nations, beginning at Jerusalem. And you are witnesses of these things. Behold, I said the promise of my Father upon you. But tarry in the city of Jerusalem until you are endued with power from on high. And so he led them out as far as Bethany, a little town over the Mount of Olives, lifted up his hands and blessed them. And it came to pass while he blessed them that he was parted from them and carried up into heaven. And they worshipped him, returned to Jerusalem with great joy, and were continually in the temple praising and blessing God. Now Christ did stay and walked with his disciples for 40 days, did all kinds of signs and wonders in their sight, and let them understand that he indeed was resurrected, so that they would comprehend that they too would be resurrected, that they too could be brought back to life no matter how dead they were. One of the reasons that that Jesus waited for 4 days before he went to resurrect Lazarus was because everybody knew that after 4 days the body was decaying already. And God said about Jesus, it was written in Psalms that he would not see corruption, his body would not decay. So at the very point at which he would have started, he was then resurrected. Let's go to John 20 now as we wind down. Now these are such powerful lessons and such important points for us to understand as human beings. And yet it was difficult for the disciples to comprehend and understand that. In John chapter 20, if we go back to verse 26 and 27, this is the point in which Thomas, who wasn't there originally, said, I won't believe it unless I put my hand in his side. Jesus came all of a sudden after 8 days in verse 26 of John chapter 20. His disciples were again inside this room. Thomas was with them this time, and Jesus came, the doors being shut, and stood in the midst. So he didn't bother opening doors anymore. And he said to Thomas, reach your finger here, look at my hands, reach your hand here, put it in my side, and do not be unbelieving, but believing. And that's when Thomas said to him, my Lord and my God. It was incomprehensible that it could have been anything else but that. And so Thomas was able to say that. And Jesus said to him, Thomas, because you've seen me, you have believed. And you know, there was 500 people at one time that saw the resurrected Christ. 500 at one time. And I don't know how many others, you know, in between that would have seen him. But at one meeting, there were 500 people. Dozens and dozens of others saw him as well, touched him and handled him. And those 500, their witness could not be refuted. It's sort of like something that happened in your life a long time ago. You know that these things did occur and happen. I remember the day that my father was buried. All of us in our family remember that day precisely and exactly what happened. And as we all walked together, and we all have to bear witness to it. We were there. We saw it. And it did happen. And so the disciples did the same. They were God's witnesses. And even when they replaced Judas, remember what they said? We've got to get somebody who has seen all of these things, who has been witness to all of these things, including the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. Those words were written for everybody who didn't live in that time, but came afterwards. 100 A.D., 200 A.D., 300, 400, 500, 1,000 A.D., and then 2003 A.D., your turn and mine. And there are miracles, brethren. The book that you have in your hand is a miracle. There's no book on the face of the earth like it has been preserved for thousands of years like this book has been. The witness of all these people. And then verse 30, truly Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples. They're not written in this book. But these things are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ and the Son of God, and believing you may have life in his name. So only a few things are written of the many, many miracles that happened. It is our believing that makes the sacrifice of Jesus Christ worthwhile. He died because he knew that 2,000 years later people would believe. That's why God was so careful with these witnesses, so patient with these witnesses. That's why Christ stayed for 40 more days to reinforce that understanding and that knowledge, so that 2,000 years later we could lean upon the examples and the experiences of these witnesses as we keep the Passover and the Sabbath days. And this year, as it happens to fall, just exactly in line with the week it was in the death of Jesus Christ. And let's close then by going to Hebrews chapter 7. Paul, who was decades after Jesus, he wrote this book of Hebrews probably 30 years after Jesus died. And Paul didn't see these events that we're talking about. He wasn't there during the time of these events. Now, he may have been a young man amongst the Pharisees, but maybe not even in Jerusalem. He didn't see these things, but he did, in a sense, experience them later on through the teachings of Jesus Christ personally. In verse 23 of Hebrews chapter 7, it says, "Also, there were many priests because they were prevented by death from continuing." So priests would come and go. In each generation, a whole bunch of new priests were there. "But he," that is Christ, "because he continues forever, has an unchangeable priesthood." It's a priesthood of Melchizedek, which existed before the Levites were ever thought of. It was a priesthood of Melchizedek that was right back there from the very beginning, the Word and the Logos. And the Levites just worked within or under that umbrella of the Melchizedek priesthood. But when the Levites, when God had to divorce Israel, the Levitical priesthood ended and Melchizedek priesthood continued. So the ministers of today are of the Melchizedek priesthood. "Therefore, he is also able to save to the uttermost those who come to God through him, since he always lives to make intercessions for them. For such a high priest was fitting for us, who is holy and harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, has come higher than the heavens, who does not need daily, as those high priests, to offer up sacrifices, first for his own sins, then for the people's. But this he did once and for all when he offered himself. For the law appoints as high priests men who have weaknesses, but the word of the oath, which came after the law, appoints the Son, who has been perfected forever." So this priesthood of Jesus Christ does continue. And it is a comfort to understand that before the throne of God the Father, right now, there is this resurrected Christ who knew what it was like to be hurt, to be betrayed, to be cold, as he said, to be hungry at times, to be thirsty at times, to be misunderstood, to find confusion there. He knew what it was like. He knew what it was like to feel down in the dumps, sad, depressed. Because when he faced his death, all these things struck him. He is there for you and for me, the resurrected Jesus Christ, not walking this earth, which he was in those days, but seated at the very throne of God. Through the Spirit of God, he lives in you and for you and for me. So that which was unexpected became one of the greatest events and blessings for this world, yet to understand and yet to know. But the day will come where all will be keeping these holy days, and those events then that took place at that time will be clear for the whole world.